Some of you did sit up front. Thank you for making it a little cozier. Welcome. My name is Elizabeth Ann Terry. I'm the Congregational Giving Specialist with the Stewardship and Development Department at the Unitarian Universalist Association. And yes, all of that can fit on a business card. Welcome to this last of a series of workshops and panels offered by the Stewardship and Development Department around legacy, our legacy as Unitarians, as Universalists, as Unitarian Universalists. An opportunity to look at race, class, and culture as it influences our faith tradition and how our faith tradition is influenced by those intersections in our country. Welcome. We have wonderful panelists this afternoon. Really appreciative of the three of you donating some of your time here at the New Orleans GA to be with us and share what is happening in your communities and your congregations. Thank you very much. I will introduce the panelists, and they will each have some time to share. And then we perhaps will have some time for question and answers and to learn more about your congregations and what is happening there. I passed out some copies of something that some of you might be able to identify. Who knows what that is that I passed out?
A goose.
A goose, okay, could be.
A seed.
A what?
A letter seed.
It could be. Anybody else who's not on the panel know what that is? It's a Sankofa bird. And you may notice that it is walking forward, yet looking backwards. There's something to be learned from our past, and we can go back and get it and bring it forward. So we're going to learn something about that today. When I was visiting the Charleston, South Carolina congregation, they have a Sankofa memorial at the entrance to their burial yard. That congregation, the Unitarian congregation in Charleston, South Carolina, dates from the late 1700s. And like a lot of southern cities, things that were built by slaves. When they were doing some renovations recently to their congregation's main sanctuary, they discovered a lot of handmade bricks. Bricks made with the hands of slaves. You could see palm prints and fingerprints. And what they decided to do with these found bricks was to build this Sankofa memorial to them. So you can see that on their website, and you can see that when you go to visit Charleston, South Carolina. So we might hear something about Sankofa today from our panelists, but we are looking forward to being educated, enlightened, thrilled, and challenged. Is that enough? Okay, wait a minute. I'm supposed to introduce you a little bit better than that. Okay, I got carried away with Sankofa. I went to the back and coming forward. So these panelists have been involved, all three of them, in interesting interfaith work in their communities and multicultural work in their communities. And they have been awarded by their communities for their interfaith work and their work with their communities. Caden Frawley is a member of the Countryside Church UU in Palatine. Am I saying that right? Palatine, Illinois. And she's a youth representative on the Board of Trustees. She's a lifelong UU, as well as an Activate NOLA and Summer Seminary 2016 graduate. Ask her later about the summer seminary. There might be some people in your congregation that would be interested in that. And she hopes of having a ministerial career so we can look forward to a future year celebrating her ministry at the service of the living tradition. Hey, we're in the South. Can I get an amen? Amen. All right. And she's served as a chaplain and is very involved in the area youth council. John Leaker is an archivist at Neville Lombard Theological School and secretary treasurer of UU Collegium and treasurer of the Unitarian Universalist Humanist Association. An archivist. Love it, love it, love it. So he's going to tell us something about something. All right. He works in the intersection of historical memory and social justice. He believes that the past can help us find a prophetic voice for the future. And Reverend Nathan Ryan is a minister at the Unitarian Church of Baton Rouge and has been there for years. And I'm not from here. Did I say Baton Rouge kind of reasonably right? Baton Rouge?
No, you were right the first
time. Okay. A native of Louisiana and part of the church's racial reconciliation work. I give you our panelists. Please welcome them.
All right, so I suppose, can you all hear me? Nope.
Yes.
Yes. All right, so I suppose I'm speaking first.
Yes. We're going down the panel.
Yes.
Thank you. Sorry that I didn't clarify that.
No. I was trying to be humble on it. I'm the second minister at the Unitarian Church of Baton Rouge. The church was founded in 1951, and we are in the process, we're calling it the Naming Project, where we're trying to name all of the enslaved people who've ever worked on the land in the church. And I think that's why I was asked to be here today. So I had a sneaking suspicion. So most of Baton Rouge, as most any city along the Mississippi River, especially downriver, has a long history of enslavement, labor, and plantations. And we're a little away from the river, but I had an idea that we would be, that we may have had some enslaved people on the land. The church is 100 years, founded 100 years post-emancipation. So it wasn't entirely clear, our connection. But so we have a chunk of land, and so I actually want to tell you a little of how we did the research. We bought the land from a woman, but the woman just gave us a part of her land, so we had to start researching back who she sold the land, you know, where she got the land from and where her grandfather got the land from and where her great-great-grandfather got the land from. And so we went to the clerk of court. We actually hired an abstractor to go through and find who originally owned the land. And we eventually found it. It was a man named James McHatton, and he bought it from a man named something Holt. And it kind of goes back further and further. And what was really unique when we found it, in 1855, there was a bill of sale. And on that bill of sale, it listed the names of 44 people that were being sold along with the property. And so we had someone actually transcribe those names so we could read them, because all the bills of sale were handwritten. And we read them in worship as a way of honoring the land that we're on. So we found that the name of the property that the church is on, it was called the Cortana Plantation, which is also the name of the mall a few blocks away. But it had another name, which they called it, the Little Misery Plantation. It was a sugarcane plantation. And if you don't know that much about the sugarcane labor camps, they were pretty violent and terrible. So it was not a good life for those people who lived there. And it was very large. We are one small block of probably many, many acre plantation. And so you should also know that this country has gone through great lengths to make sure we didn't know the names of the people who are enslaved. And we're actually trying to find not just the names of those 44, but who their children were and who their parents were, to figure out who was on the land. So here's some of the problems. One, we only know the names of the people when the plantation was sold. That's just one snapshot. So we don't know all of the people who actually lived or worked or were killed on that land. They aren't listed in the census. They don't have a birth record or a death record. And we're actually on the border of able to find and not able to find. So the Catholics, because Baton Rouge is right on the border between the British America and the French South Louisiana, the Catholics track every birth and every death. So you can actually go to baptismal records from the 1700s and 1800s and see the name of any person born. McHatton was not, we think, Catholic, which means all of the people who were born on the under his watch, we don't know their name or when they were born. So we can only go based on bills of sale or anyone who's brought into the state of Louisiana. And Louisiana actually has better records than most states. So so when we listed the 44, so our ultimate goal is to actually identify the name of every person we can enslaved on the land, and then to put a memorial listing their name somewhere on the property. And then if we're able to go beyond that, to actually hire a genealogist to find out who the descendants of those enslaved were and to start building a relationship with them. So that's sort of why I was asked to be on here. And there's a few interesting things. So we listed the 44 names in worship, and the newspaper found out about it, and they wrote a story. And so I got a call the next week, and it was from an African-American woman who was tracing her family's history because she wanted to know who her ancestors were. So one of the things for me as a white person, I have a pretty easy time figuring out who my ancestors were. For many who come out of enslavement, there's a hard deadline of where their ancestry research stops. So she was researching her family and found out she also stopped on this man, McHatton. And there's actually, he owned two properties, an Arlington plantation and the Little Misery plantation. And the Baton Rouge Church is located on the Little Misery plantation. So when she called and talked to me, I don't know her name, she had done the same research I had done, and she kept talking about how McHatton was probably a good man and didn't abuse his people. And that really stood out to me. That for people whose ancestors were enslaved, that they have to trace the people who enslaved them as the only way to find their ancestors. And they have to wonder about how violent or peaceful their enslavers were. And so this may be, the easy work is to say, oh, well, the South had slavery, this is a project that should just happen in Louisiana. Well, Unitarian Universalism decided to not locate many of their churches where there were enslaved people. So most of the churches are not, or where we decided to tell the story of where people were enslaved. So most churches think they don't have to do this work. In some ways, Baton Rouge has to do this work less than most of our Unitarian and Universalist congregations, because we bought the land 100 years after enslavement. But I would love to see a church where every congregation looks at their history. There was slavery in New Jersey, I think, until the 1860s. It's not talked about much because it doesn't fit the story. I would love for churches to figure out how much of their endowments come out of the violence towards enslaved people. And just because this also needs to be said, in the South, we had very rich planter or very rich, rich plantation owners, and then very poor whites, and then enslaved people. The crops harvested by the enslaved went north to textile factories, and the money got into towns like Lowell, Massachusetts. And that money then got distributed amongst the rich factory owners and all of the workers in that plant. So in some ways, the diversity of wealth in a lot of the country comes directly out of the enslavement and abuse of the enslaved in Louisiana and in the Deep South. And so in some ways, the work that we're doing in the Baton Rouge Church is just a taste of what maybe most Unitarian Universalist churches could or should be doing. And I don't think I need to take my whole time. There's great resources on how to do this own research. A woman who spoke at General Assembly last year, her name is Sharon Morgan, she does this ancestral research a lot. And there's some talented genealogists who can do it. I don't know if you heard about Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. found out that the Catholic Church, to keep their university alive, sold off 272 enslaved people. Most of them wound up in Louisiana and Baton Rouge. And because it was Catholic, it was easier to do that ancestral research than if they were Protestant. So this work could be done in almost all of our congregations. So I think you've heard plenty. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. We'll have some questions after all three have spoken, if that's all right. I see lots of nodding heads. Thank you.
Okay, can you hear me? Because there we go. Now I have a mic stand. For whatever reason, the one mic doesn't stand. Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, guys. I feel really cool. Okay, so as they said, my name is Caden Frawley. I am from Palatine, Illinois, so north of Chicago in the suburbs, not really Chicago, but I like to pretend. And so, obviously, I'm very young. I have done very little with strictly adult groups of people, and especially in the association, I've done very little with strictly adult groups of people, but I've been insanely active in the youth community. And so, both in my region, in the Mid-America region, and nationally, I've served on the Northern Area Youth Council, which runs our conferences. I'm a youth chaplain. I'm a luminary leader, so recognized nationally as a UU youth or young adult leader. We have what's called MUSA, which is our Midwest UU Summer Assembly, which is kind of a giant family camp. I ran our high school group for that for a year. I did all kinds of cool things. And so the list continues to go on and on, and I've spent the last 5-6 years doing every type of leadership opportunity I could possibly get my hands on. And so what better can I talk about besides youth leadership in our association? And so most importantly for me is that last year I graduated from Summer Seminary 2016 and am hopefully on the path to the wonderful world of settled pulpit ministry. And so how I got into youth leadership was I was that kid who went to youth group every single Sunday because I had nothing better to do than to get up early on a Sunday and go to youth group. And so I went every single week without fail. And there are plenty of people in this room who can account to the fact that I was the person who had to put every single point out there into the conversation. No one else could talk for about half an hour. And so I was the person that everyone would look to and be like, we can't really handle you. We need to send you to someone else to learn some leadership skills because clearly it's not working really well. And so I got pointed in all kinds of directions for regional and national leadership. And so I needed somewhere to gain more effective and non-overbearing leadership skills and to learn that I was not the only opinion in the room. Shocking to say. And so I found plenty of youth conferences and summer camps, and this created a snowball effect of networking and a gaining of leadership opportunities. And so through all of this, I became called to the ministry at 14. And prior to feeling called, I wanted to be a geneticist. I wanted to be in STEM and do lots and lots of science, and realized very quickly that once you're really apt at something, you think you should have a career in it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's what you want to do every single day for the rest of your life. And so youth leadership opportunities allowed me to realize my potential in a world outside of the classroom. It allowed me to gain all kinds of interpersonal skills and meet people from all different backgrounds rather than a mostly white high school of people who are raised in a middle to upper income area, which doesn't have a lot of diversity and doesn't have a lot of diverse perspectives that can encompass the majesty that the UU community around the country can. And so I really felt called through Unitarian Universalism because I wasn't conformed to the specific box of my area. And so most of this came through youth leadership. You can imagine if you send a kid across the country to meet 20 or so new people their same age who are kind of in their same box of they don't know a lot of people who are into the same wacky UU nerdness that I like to call it, and they have to do something. They're either trained in leadership, or they're trained in racial justice, or gender justice, or they're trained in how to be a chaplain, or any different kind of leadership opportunity, that they're not only going to gain this educational background, but they're going to gain a bunch of people who they can say, I can reach out to you through Facebook and understand this problem that I'm having back at home and how to incorporate the things that I learned into my community through this assistance of this youth network. And so it teaches you to fight for the injustices that you see, because you are no longer the only person who sees these issues, because you know that there are other people out there, even if they're all the way across the country, who recognize these very similar issues, and they can support you even when it's really frightening to point out at an all-white high school that maybe we're not doing the best for our students of color. Maybe we're not doing the best for our LGBTQ folks. Like, maybe we're not doing everything that we can, and you're no longer the one person who is the outcast and is laughed at for caring too much. And so it gives them the possibility to no longer be this weird kid. And outside of these educational benefits, they gain social experiences that 10, 20 years down the line, even if they aren't participating in all kinds of UUA type things, that they can call up and be like, hey, I have a friend who's from this state, which makes me feel cool because I know more people. And you hang out with them and you learn more about them. You learn more about their experience in their life and how dramatically different it is from yours, and how that can make you change how you interact with other people in the future. And so it also teaches you a lot of how to deal with conflict. Of, I went to Activate New Orleans, which was a racial justice training. I had never done any kind of advocacy work or any kind of justice work specifically for racial justice issues, and so I was shocked out of my shell to realize that as a white person, I clearly don't know 100% of the experience of people of color. And so it's those kind of things, for especially for youth, that it's easier to shake them out of the normality because they've been living it for a shorter period of time. And so you can have these people who, even as young as 6, 7, 8 years old, who you can tell them that it's not okay to treat people differently because of their race, and you should work to help allow people to have greater experiences, even if they have these injustices placed upon them by our society, and they'll go, okay. And they'll go off and continue to do all different things with their life. And so for the association's future, I think it's really interesting how we invest in our youth leadership. Of our youth leadership is usually sectioned off for the kids who were like me, who youth group leaders and congregations don't really know how to deal with and need to rein in and readjust. And you send them there because you think they have this great leadership potential. They have all of this ability. When we really should be focusing it to every single youth, we need to be focusing it to the youth who don't voice their opinion as often. We need to focus it on the youth who may not come to church every single Sunday because maybe they work, maybe they have other family things, maybe they do a bunch of different things that we're not reaching them as well, and we're losing out on that opportunity to reach a significantly larger group of people for our future. And so too few congregations actively encourage every single youth to seek things outside of their congregation. And too few adults realize that those opportunities even exist. And so youth leadership not only creates and molds the minds of our future association leaders, our ministers, our DREs, all different kinds of people, but it also is for the future of our innovators, our creative thinkers, our people who are going to change things in the real world that can make it a more peace and just place to be. And so it's really, what I would like to see happen is that all youth have a voice in the association, which we try to say exists, but really we only see the voices that keep showing up because they find one and another and another. We need to invest in helping every single youth find that first leadership opportunity. Because youth, being our futures, it would be a complete disservice if we did not continue to expand these leadership opportunities. Because we can work on the current, and we can work on educating the adults of the current, but if we don't invest in the youth of the future, to coin the corny term, if we don't invest in the youth currently, then we're not going to move as productively forward as fast as possible. That's all I have.
Thank you.
So I'm sort of angling. I'm sorry, you a little bit more. So I'm John Leisure, and I'm an archivist, and I think about legacies all the time. So we have, like, our endowments, right? We have the physical buildings, the resources we have. Our legacies are, like, in inertia that kind of pushes us forward or draws us backward. We also have, like, the legacy of our mission. Like, what have we inherited from the past that brings us into the future? The legacy I'm interested in are memory. How do we remember our past? What tools and resources do we have to understand ourselves, to understand our legacy? And we really do it in two types of ways. One is, I call this, like, the wall of famous you use. You've probably seen the poster hung somewhere, and it has a picture of famous you use. These posters say a lot about our movement. Older ones are nearly exclusively old dead white guys. Thomas Jefferson, William Ellery Channing, Emerson, Bellows, Taft. In the 1980s, we began to look more critically in our past, and then we began to discover a rich tradition of women, people of color, and other UUs who aren't presidents and don't have parks named after them. Right? So we added Sarah Margaret Fuller. We added Whitney Young. We also removed Thomas Jefferson. And this is one way in which we tame our legacy. We see ourselves as a legacy of heretics and rebels and outcasts who acted on these deeper principles and moved us forward. That's one construct we use to conceptualize our historical legacy. The other one is we look for a constant. And I'm going to disagree with Theodore Parker, so I'm taking a risk here. But in Theodore Parker's 1841 essay, The Transient and the Permanent of Christianity, he contrasts the transient nature of Christianity, the creeds, the forms, the hymns, with the underlying religious core. And Parker puts forth, we should seek out this core. And this is the other way we understand our history. We have such theological diversity, such a long period of time, and we imagine if we can just dig deep enough, if we can find that underlying core that everybody has in common, well, that's our legacy. That's Unitarian Universalism, that unchanging truth, or truths. But we still look for this core. I think both of these are deeply, deeply problematic ways to understand our past. They exclude so many experiences. And even with, like, the wall of great UUs, even though we include women, it's still just the great man of history conception, right? We cram these experiences in this patriarchal concept, this white supremacist concept. And with this search for a core, we erase our diversity, we erase our messiness. And I think both of these ways really mean we lose our legacy. The way we understand our past is limited. So how do we get out of this conception of legacy? How do we understand ourselves better? There's many ways. I'm an archivist, so I will give the archive answer. But first I have to say, archives have perpetuated this problem. You go to a historical archive, and it's all dead white guys, mainly from Boston. They're categorized in this very kind of Western Enlightenment perspective. They organize the documents, the papers, in these ways. So, archives traditionally operate like a tree, right? You have a trunk, branch, a smaller branch, a leaf. We put everything in a specific little hierarchy, a specific classification. It's this Western Enlightenment kind of conception of thinking. And it's useful. If somebody wants to read a sermon from 1961, it's really good to, you know, go down the tree and find the exact place of the sermon from 1961. But this silos off reflection. So, as we go onward, we're trying to think about archives rhizomatically. So think like a piece of mold or a piece of fungus. It's flat, it's not linear, it's not hierarchical. Every point connects to every other point directly. It allows our Puritan collections to talk directly to our pagan collections. And it breaks down the conceptual frameworks we try to foist our legacy upon. So one example of this is, we recently received in 2014 almost 400 boxes from the UUA when they were moving from 25 Beacon to 24 Farms. These documents contain a file on every single congregation in the UUA. They stretch from around 1920 to around 1990, but they really get the mid-century, the fellowship, this kind of explosion of Unitarian churches, and this kind of sea change that our movement underwent with these new fellowship movement, increasing number of women ministers, this really major change.
And this is a change we don't really conceptualize in our legacies, right? What does a bottom-up history look like? Right? Ministers come and go. Congregations stay. Yet we remember in terms of ministers. Right? We remember in terms of ideas, but not experience. Right? We perpetuate the worst parts of our theology, right? This kind of intellectual ideas unmoored from reality and lived experience. That is our legacy, how we choose to create it. So with these congregational records, we're trying to facilitate bottom-up research so we can see how does Unitarian Universalism live? What is our lived legacy? What did our predecessors, what do our elders, how did they live that Unitarian Universalism when they were younger? What are these? Because our archives generally don't tell that story. And so now we get researchers asking, it's a fellowship. And they're like, we think our 50th anniversary is coming up, but we're not quite sure. Right? Because they don't have, that's not in their legacy. They have not created a legacy that's important. So I can send them a scanned copy of their application to the UUA with the signatures of that first generation. I can send the field reports, the pictures, and give them their legacy that tells their experiences, not the experiences of the leads, not the intellectual story, but the actual lived story of Unitarian Universalism. I think this gets to the next thing, that this issue of our legacy is really fundamentally an issue of social justice. Who is remembered, who is forgotten, and who gets to tell the story? So this rhizomic model just doesn't create a more accurate history, it creates a more just history. So one of the things we're going to be more on, Mark, is we're trying to think who has been erased from the archive. And how do we bring all perspectives and voices back into the archive and then back into our historical memory of our legacy? So we have what we call special collections. A special collection is a series of archival collections pertaining to a single event, theme, or movement within Unitarian Universalism. Special collections empower communities underserved by archives to preserve and make accessible their history. We currently have 6 special collections. Our Sankofa Special Collection, which tells the story of UU's color. Our McLean collection tells the story of religious education. Our Quintos collection tells the story of Latino and Latina UUs. Our Humanist collection tells the story of humanism. Our Heresies collection, and the her is bolded, sorry, second wave feminist, tells the story of UU women. And we have an international collection that tells the story of Unitarian and Universalist outside of the United States. And these don't just categorize content. They allow us to be meaningful, accountable relationships with communities. So as we help preserve their story, they're the ones telling it, not us. So I'm going to talk specifically about Sankofa, who's our oldest and most established special collection. And I'm going to read it, because it's important. Sankofa words are not mine, they're Sankofa words. So this is the document that Sankofa's created about its purpose. The purpose of the Sankofa Special Collection is reflected in its name. Sankofa means looking to the past in order to move forward into the future. Sankofa looks into the silences and absences created by white supremacy to amplify what has been muted and to recover what has been obscured. Sankofa brings to the present the history of the people of color who have made Unitarian Universalism a home. It looks into the future to preserve and make accessible substantial and ongoing impact of Unitarian Universalism of color. Led by the community it serves, the Sankofa Special Collection creates policies and methods of organization so that people of color can locate their identities and experiences within Unitarian Universalism. So this is the legacy we're trying to bring up, a legacy that includes everyone. In this process, we've really learned how can we live our Unitarian Universalist values as an archive and also as a community of memory. And so some of the unique things we've done at Sankofa is we have broken a lot of archiving principles because the collections, mainly gathered by Martin Morrison Reed, were scattered and fragmented and messy. They didn't come to us cleanly. They didn't come to us directly. So we had to figure out how to incorporate these origins that reflect the erased, obscured, and damaged nature of the documents in the way we try to push these stories away. We also even immediately figured out that the category of Sankofa was not without its problems because Latino and Latina UUs, their identities, they weren't seeing it in the structure of Sankofa, so now we have our Quintos collection. Because we're listening to the community and realizing our framework of creating this historical memory was erasing, even in our good faith effort to do it, we were still perpetuating this process of erasure. So that's why we spun off the Quintos collection, which is different kind of categories, different ways of thinking about memory. We create custom metadata. All archiving is naming things. That's a sermon. That's a letter. That's from Jacob. That's from John Doe. But those categories, you start doing again and again, and you start siloing off collections. So we have a custom set of metadata that we use to describe these collections. That's unique to Unitarian Universalism. We don't use the standard set that the larger farmers use. And also, it's a different method for acquisition. So we actually listen to the community. We listen to the stories out there and we say, how can we help you tell your story? How can we ensure that you're not forgotten? How do you want to tell your story the next 100 years? And by preserving it, by digitizing it, we're able to help begin this work of creating a legacy of faculty representatives. We have digitized 8,000 pages of documents in Sankofa. They're freely accessible online to anybody who searches. Everything that is typed is text searchable. And we've used our system of metadata to help make this collection rhizomatic, to help make it not hierarchical, but flat and open and messy in the way that actual reality is. So, in my little section, I'm talking about another type of legacy, and it's that we're all part of our legacies. So, a woman called me, and she was cleaning out her attic, and she had papers from the Gay Caucus, which was the early 1970s LGBT group in Unitarian Universalism. And they were early 1970s gay liberation. They have this wonderful pin that they wear that says, "How dare you presume I'm straight?" This is 1971. And she was active, she was kind of winding down her life, and she's a retired minister, and she's like, "We're about to throw these away. Do you want them?" And I'm like, "Of course we want them. Ship them tomorrow. Who'll reimburse you?" She had no idea that her legacy was important, that her history, because we imagine our history in the wall of famous you use, we imagine our history as this permanent, magical, metaphysical core. We don't imagine it that we're part of it. So as we think about a historical legacy and the ways in which we remember self, the fundamental reality is we're all part of it. And it's substantial, and we need to have intellectual and theological and cultural tools to incorporate all the experiences.
So I don't have to go over there and block your view. Thank you so much. You, all three of you made me think. I saw all of the connections between all of you. I had some questions or comments, but I wanted to see what y'all were thinking, and don't be shy. I made you move up front. So there's a mic there. There's one here. There's one over at the podium. Questions or comments?
I get to be first. Hi. Alex Landefeld from UUCNH in Pittsburgh. For John, how do you take the tree, branch, branch, leaf records and make them into rhizomatic records? Rhizomatic resonates with me because I have historically been a grower of bamboo, and that stuff grows rhizomatically. Thank you.
So I think it's two ways. It's one, it's our conceptual structure of how we imagine our collections. We don't try to give them soft light. So we have a pamphlet collection that's about 10,000 pamphlets. And currently right now, it's just categorized by name of author. Not content, not subject, not time period. So by giving things good descriptive metadata, instead of having a pamphlet with one point of access, it has 10 points of access. And those 10 points of access use the same vocabulary that a sermon does, that a book does, and it's just kind of, it amplifies itself as you scale it up. We also, as we orientate researchers to the archive, I just don't want you to touch everything without, like, you know, knowing how to be careful and not break our 100-year-old documents. But it's also orienting the idea of thinking about archives in this term, of actually have discovery and happenstance, and embrace this kind of messy understanding of the past. So it's kind of like building conceptual tools to go along with the kind of more nitty-gritty issues of metadata and access. But it's just being thorough and also embracing that we're UU. We're a UU seminary, so our identity really informs our work. So we aren't just going to absorb like what the Library of Congress does, because we have a community that we serve and we're part of, and that informs our work. So like we know the difference between a Unitarian or Universalist church or a fellowship, and we actually lean into that and start looking for those distinctions.
Thank you.
So each of you touched on justice in one way or another. So my question was, like, so at this moment in time, this snapshot, how do you think Unitarian Universalists in the future will look back on this moment that we're in the context of justice, whether that's economic or personal justice or immigrant justice, however you want to frame it? How will Unitarian Universalists in the future look back on this moment as an opportunity for justice? Anybody.
I'll go. Okay, so I think in terms of justice, if we think back into the past, aside from Unitarian Universalism specifically, if we think of the 50s, 60s, 70s, a lot of us jump straight to racial justice. If we think about the early 1900s, a lot of us jump straight to gender justice. If we think of one very specific type of justice being very focused on one specific entity. And so I think if Unitarian Universalists in the future look back on the current Unitarian Universalism in a snapshot that we have now, it'll be looked at very differently in comparison to a lot of other time periods of, we are right now very diversely spread out, and we have many, 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 many projects and areas that we are trying to tackle at the same time, which is, in my opinion, currently working pretty well for us. But I think in the future, they will look back on this as a time separate from in the past, where we've had a lot of specific ideas that we tackle one at a time, that now we are trying to tackle many at the same time. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Oh, there's a question.
Let me just add, we are the Google generation, so we can do many different things all at once.
Either of you?
Yes? I just want to give you the opportunity first.
I would say at this moment, what separates us is the disbursement of power. That this current Black Lives Review, as an example, is a movement that is not particularly minister-centric, which is unique within the history of Unitarian Universalism. That this bottom-up advocacy and different models of community, I think we have a structure within the association that is finally allowing these different ways of beloved community and different conceptions of beloved community to bubble up. Because this isn't top-down dictated change, right? This kind of moment we're in, this past like 6 months, as it kind of came up from the bottom. And I think that allows, that broader base allows for more substantial and ongoing engagement than prior attempts, which were more top-down, which were less democratic. So I think what you'll see is, I don't know how this ends up, but I think the causal chain, or this moment, that is what's unique at this moment, is that I think the energy is coming from different places than prior before.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about the future, and I wonder if this is a blip or a transformation point. So, if you see an uncomfortable mole on your skin, do you put makeup on it and hope it's going to be okay? Or do you go try to get treated, see if it's a problem, get treated? We keep talking, I don't know that anyone here said this, but we keep talking about what has happened in the UUA recently as a crisis. And I struggle to see it as a crisis. I see it as a thing that happened, has been happening for a long time, and we've finally seen it. And by we, I mean some people. So, the way we as a country and we as a faith engage with race sometimes is transformative, and sometimes we talk about it for a while, and then we say, well, we already talked about that, let's move on. And I worry that that's what we're going to do. I worry that this is just going to be a thing where we have some metric of achievement, and we, once we hit that metric, we say we're done. Instead of admitting that this is a deeper, larger problem. And the reason I'm concerned, and the reason that I feel strongly about the work that I'm doing should be the work that, not me, the church is doing, should be the work that the association is doing, our country felt okay about slavery by separating out us and them to say, oh, those people do slavery. We don't. We're not at fault for that, even though we're getting the money from it. And then post-emancipation, those people, and I am those people, the white Southerners, those people have a problem with racism. We don't have a problem with racism because our segregation is written into the housing laws, not into the school segregation laws. Then after that, those people have a problem with being red people because we think we're blue people. And if you look at all of the black estates, those are also the most consistently red states. So there's some complicated stuff that's going on. And so when I see us as a faith talking about how different we are than someone else, I worry that we're not getting to the core of the problem. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So.
So I was wondering what advice the three of you might have to assist congregations in telling the real truth around racial relations in their congregation. And whether they were founded in 1968, as mine was, as a fellowship in Wilmington, North Carolina, or it was it's 300 years old and it's in Massachusetts and it was accepting cotton from the South and making garments and, you know, employing children. Whatever it was, what is your advice on congregations? And we all have some truth to tell that we don't want to tell, or it's difficult to tell, or we struggle to tell, or we don't even know it. Like that congregation in Charleston knew that the building was built by slaves, but like having seen the concrete thing of the bricks transformed them into this social justice monster where they just can't stop moving forward on that. So how do people stop research, start telling the truth, and move forward?
Four stories, really quickly, but they're two pairs. So Lee Blobart's story is we were founded in the 1840s to train ministers to serve in the West, right? Because fancy Boston ministers weren't really willing to leave the confines of Boston and go on the frontier, so we were in Newport, Pennsylvania. That's one story. It was 100% accurate. The other story is we were training ministers to serve on the edge of empire as empire expanded out. Both those stories are true. Right. How do you have a conceptual and theological and spiritual framework to hold both of them up? The other duality, or two pairs of stories, are stories of fellowships. A lot of fellowships in the mid-century were these beautiful imaginings of beloved community, these new ways of people finding community in often hostile areas, right? The fellowships around college towns, in military bases, when you have people coming from different parts of the country into a state, into a community, they don't feel a part of, and they create these wonderful communities. That's one story. The other story is fellowships nearly directly mapped white flight and created white churches in all white neighborhoods, while the traditional congregations that couldn't leave the city are the ones that were more adequately, at least beginning to think about race, right? So I think both to hold both stories, like the beautiful stories are true and the other stories are true, and having to have the wisdom to understand that and then figure out what that means. But the first thing is you have to understand the stories you tell yourself are true and meaningful, but there's other stories that are just as true and meaningful. And it's not they contradict and disprove each other, but they're both there. And if you just leave it in the basement, it's just going to sit there and you're going to have this your legacy pulls you down. You don't know why, you don't know how, but the monster's in the basement still. So I also have a better answer, but the first step is holding two truths like that together.
I think a lot of it comes down to using frameworks of credibility, because a lot of us can go back into our church and tell 5, 10, 15 people, oh, I learned this wonderful thing, and we can start implementing all of these different models, and we can start trying to reach out to these types of people and start trying to do all these different things. The issue with that is that, one, you're not reaching out to your community and your community's circumstance. You're taking something from a separate community and trying to implement it into yours. Second off, a lot of people are just going to push you off because they weren't there with you, so they don't know how credible it was, the material that you learned. Mm-hmm. Versus if you go, I went to GA, and GA's theme was Resist and Rejoice, and we learned all these different things from this organization and this organization and this. And we can go on their websites, we can talk to their ambassadors, we can talk to their people, and we can try to implement some of the things that they know work to try to dismantle these negative systems into our specific community. And so it comes down to both admitting your fault in the situation and admitting that you don't have all the answers, but also being the person to say, I know where the answers come from, and I know where we can try to be better.
So I think I kind of agree. I don't know that, you know the Peter Pan story about Tinkerbell was so small she could only feel one emotion at a time? Well, we're not fairies, and we can feel multiple emotions at once. And so we can actually, I think of them as more like playing a chord on a piano. You know, one note doesn't cancel the other out. They just go together. And, you know, maybe it's because I'm from the South and I serve in the South. But I think if you can just get people to see it. So the God that I know is that pull towards justice and kindness. Not that God pulls people towards justice and kindness, but that when people are pulled towards justice and kindness, I see that as God's work. And so the God that I know is that pull. And I have faith that if we can just show people the systems that have been used to oppress, that it'll be enough to pull them. You know, if we can, you don't get a plant to come out by yanking on it. You give it the right environment, you know, and the right food and the right water and the right sunlight. And that's how you get, you know, a plant to grow. And I don't think it's as scary as everyone says. All it really takes saying is this country was founded to put white people ahead of other people. This country was also founded to put rich white people ahead of poor and working class white people. And to do that, to keep whites and blacks from teaming up to overthrow, I think it's important that we just say there's different cultures, and they're different. So I talk about my experience as a white Southern Louisianian, not as good or bad, but as a clarifier of what my particular cultural expression is. And so someone who is black or who is Vietnamese or who is Minnesotan, they all have different cultural expressions than I do. Not better or worse, they just are. And that they can exist together. And I think we need to acknowledge that we as a faith have been, you know, so the black empowerment controversy happened in the late 60s where a group of black Unitarian Universalists were asking for access to power and the finances to make that happen. Well, I think there were two black empowerment controversies. One was that where we denied them the financial support to be leaders. And the other was the one we don't talk about because it doesn't fit in our narrative. And maybe this is what you're talking about. If there was one city in the country that was more amenable to Unitarian Universalism in the 1960s, it was got to be Selma, Alabama. And we don't have a church there. And just to name it, I'm going to say sort of flippantly, I wonder what the demographics are of Selma, Alabama. So we haven't even tried giving this faith to predominantly black communities. So I wonder what... So we're not even there yet in terms of trusting black people or Latinx people or so many groups of people. We aren't even there yet with trusting them with our faith. And I think until we examine that, I don't know that we're going to get there.
Thinking of like forgotten legacies, we have tried sometimes in business first. So like in the 1960s on the south side of Chicago, there was a black humanist fellowship led by Louis McGee, an African-American minister, former A&E minister. Like, we have these little stories, but we don't have the containers to remember them. We don't have the institutional memory, the cultural practice. Like, we have models. small, not big. Mm-hmm. Like, right, if it was big, I think we'd, but like, we have these little, the model plants, right? We have these little green leaves popping up. And we plucked them early, or we forgot about them, or we buried them, or we put too much fertilizer on them. But they're there. But we don't have the containers for them, like, to remember them, to then draw upon this history. Because one of the history of Sankofa is, we have had youths of color who have led our denomination, right? Board presidents, or we've had it. We just never had the containers to remember it. So it's been forgotten. It's been erased. And then now we can't stand on their shoulders and go forward because we've forgotten. So I think you're right. I just want to say, like, there's little stories there. It's like we have tried it in bits and pieces, but we never remembered it because we probably weren't intentional and we didn't have the structures in place to better understand ourselves.
Or like we came to New Orleans once, mm-hmm. But there was a tropical storm, and so we decided never to come again, mm-hmm. to avoid the discomfort of maybe looking at the consequences of a country failing its people, mm-hmm. for example.
And this forgetting is intentional, right? This forgetting isn't like, oh, I forgot. No, this forgetting is you forget to make you feel better. You forget to keep you in power. You forget to keep your position legitimate. It's not a passive forgetting. It's an active act of forgetting and erasure to protect yourself. Like, we don't forget these things because they were confusing or because they were small. We forget them because it benefits us. And I think that's the hard truth about some of these things. It is just perpetuation of the structures, because the structures help white people, and they help many of the leaders in how we structure our movement to this day.
Mm, thank you. I think I see a question coming from the audience. Thank you.
I'm Donna Melcher, and I'm from the Roswell, Georgia community of UMN, Unitarian Universalist Metro Atlanta North. And I really want to thank you all for this discussion. I am here, or at least I thought I was here, because I'm starting a program for our endowment for the congregation. And I really have learned, I was like sifting through it all, but I learned that one of the things that I want to talk about with our congregation is that they each have a part of this movement. And like you were saying, to memorialize that in some way. And I also learned from you about how important the youth is and the reason for involving the youth in leadership, and also the fact that if we don't have an endowment, for instance, there won't be anything around to lead, And then also I really had to go deep to think about how, endowment and the information you're talking about are connected, but really even asking people to think as they are giving a gift, ask them to think about their own, how that money came to them in order for them to be able to give it as a gift. And I just want to ask you guys, is there anything else that you feel would be a seed or something important about legacy that I could go forward with my community in helping them understand the importance of endowment and legacy for Unitarian Universalism?
I have something. So I think in terms of legacy and in terms of how we're running our organization, if we look at all of our difficulties with making certain that people of color are having all access to all parts of our association, I think that we're starting a really good project, especially with things like Thrive and Blue and Black Lives Matter, that we're giving those spaces for people of color, but we're also starting to slip a little bit back into the 60s kind of mindset of we're giving them these wonderful, wonderful spaces. They're creating their own wonderful spaces, but we're not allowing those often to blend with the pre-existing spaces. And so it's becoming a separate but unequal type situation. We're trying really hard to make sure that all of us have a space that we all feel safe and that we all are able to express what is happening to us with the injustices of our society, but we're not often taking all of those voices into the greater association. And so I think looking at our legacy, we need to continue to look at history, especially in terms of race relations, and recognize how important it is to make sure that all voices are included at the table, like they were speaking about today during general session.
So I'm stealing from someone else who said, just because it's not our fault doesn't mean we're not responsible. When I do a memorial service for someone who died from suicide or addiction, everyone knows they died from suicide or addiction, and not saying it says more than just saying it. Mm. And I actually think it's going to be okay. You know, it's just fine. So just tell people, we're going to get there. It's not all your fault. Now let's make it better. You know, and to just name the discomfort makes it much easier to handle. Because when you have to talk around it, it's almost impossible to get at. And to just say, you know, we want to build a church. And this church is imperfect. And we want it to be strong for a long time. And we're going to get better each time. And you know, we're going to make a bunch of mistakes, and then our kids are going to tell us how all the mistakes we made. And then when they have kids, their kids are going to tell them all the mistakes they made. Like, that's how we get there. But we're not going to get there if we don't have faith that we have the potential to get there. We don't give with that intent. You know, so I rented a house and I didn't plant an orange tree in the backyard because I wanted it for me. And now I own a house and I have it. But if I would have planted it a few years ago, there'd be a lot of oranges for whoever lives there now.
It's like having like an endowment is like one of the self-perpetuating legacies. Like they have their own energy and momentum and they can do so much work. It's, we have so many different ways of how we give and we ask. Lorraine Allen was the church archivist in All Souls, New York. And she spent 30 years up in this little tiny room up on the Upper West Side. Sorry, Upper East Side. They would want me to clarify that. Upper East Side. we received 150 boxes from All Souls after going through it. And her handwriting was on everything. Everything. On the folders, on the notes. She preserved it. She said, this is my community. This is my people, and I want them to be remembered. And she spent decades of her life with her handwriting. I can see it now. And it's really stuck with me as a way in which our legacy, like, the future is happening. Like, it's going to happen. And what do we give to it? And I think it's a cliche, but it really does last. Like, it's really there. The future's really going to happen. The things we know are really going to impact it. And it's how do you relate to this hypothetical or this future nebulous thing? I don't know what the answer to that is, but like it's just barreling forward. And what we do matters so, so deeply. And it is remembered, and the community remembers its past and takes care of its ancestors. Like ancestor worship is like maybe the fundamental religious instinct in some way. And how do we harness that and use that to include everybody in a just way and not just our famous people? Or our big donor who gets the rack call named after them. But everybody that contributes to the congregation as it moves forward.
Thank you. So that sounds very first principle. Every gift is important. are there any more questions? One more. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Ian Mishlick. My question was, what is a piece of the current Unitarian Universalist legacy that you believe that we should work in the future to help change, to help make different and make better for the future generations?
So what we want to change?
Yeah, just what's something that you believe is part of the current legacy that you want to be different for the future? Like, what's something that we should work on and how can we work to make it better?
Good question.
Sorry.
I think we've internalized so many cultural practices around whiteness. We have, like, normalized it and naturalized it to such an extent it's just, like, dissipated into our culture. So actually, like, acknowledging our current historical situatedness and finding out what that means, and as we imagine beloved community to be radical in what that could mean, not so being politically radical, but actually imagining new ways of being in community. Because I think we've kind of normalized a certain conception of the self, a certain conception of community, and baked in with those conceptions are some beautiful things and some very damaging things. So I would like to continue the container of beloved community in new ways, and actually really rethinking how we be in community together.
Really similarly, if you think about our Seeing the Living Tradition book, or our teal book, which I always forget what it's called, it's something similar to that. But if you think about those and you think about our worship services, we have a solid third of each of those books that are either in another language or from a tradition that is not predominantly white or things of that nature. And you get one end of the spectrum. You either get a congregation who wants to, say, sing a song that's in Spanish, but not a single one of them speaks Spanish, not a single one of them puts in the effort to look up what it means, and just want to sing it because they want to feel diverse. Or you end up with a congregation who has those people, but doesn't want to use those resources because they feel uncomfortable with it, because Unitarian Universalism, in a lot of ways, has fit itself into this mold of white culture. And we try and we try and we try to open ourselves up when we have all of these resources directly in front of us. And all we have to do is research it and find people who know what it means, find people who it means something to them. And so I think, there's a bug. And so I think in those ways that is something that we do really need to change, is that we need to open up our spaces to something beyond strictly white-based faith traditions.
So I think we need to be honest about who we are. I think we're an emotional and communal religion. The aha that I had that was embarrassingly long for me to take is whenever you see someone in fight or flight mode, they're not feeling safe. So whenever they're very defensive or they're very aggressive, they're not safe. Whenever they talk in a lot of intellectual stuff, a lot of rationalization, that's because they're not feeling safe. And so when do we really embrace humanism? And this is not a humanism bashing thing. This is us as a behavior. When did we really, and not religious humanism, but sort of the secularized, intellectualized humanism? I mean, we embraced it when we figured out about World War II and about the Holocaust. And when the world got smaller and scarier, we became intellectual. I think we use that as a defense mechanism. And I think we, as much as we like to pretend that we're hyper-individualistic as a faith, if you try to change one thing that will exclude one person who's, if you want to get rid of, please, joys and concerns, there is someone who's going to lose their mind over it, and the church will probably not let them have that, because this faith is so focused on community that it's not willing to let it. So I think what we need to, the one thing we need to do is let go of these myths of us as intellectual and individualistic, because really they're, if we go back to the alcoholism model, we'll go to the soup model. So you know when you go to the restaurant and you order soup and the waiter comes to you after about 20 minutes and says your soup's almost ready? It's never because your soup's almost ready, right? If your soup was almost ready, you would just get your soup. So they messed up in the kitchen. And we talk so much about how smart we are and about how not feeling we are, because I think we're scared and we just need to know it's okay to feel and to love each other. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. We're about out of time, but I wondered if each of you might have like a final snippet of information. One question that I do have for you, John, is like advice on where these folks should be keeping their archives.
Oh. Very practical advice. To kind of get at what you were talking about, when you think about how do you want to remember your community, emphasize the experience of being part of the community and not people, okay, congregations save sermons, but they don't save orders of service. They don't save the committee group, right? Like, they want to say, these are the ideas we thought, because this is the identity we like to imagine, instead of these are the things we felt. These are the things we were in relationship. These are the things we love. So when you think about what you're going to say, I'm not going to talk about boxes or humidity. I'm just going to say what you feel, say what you live, so you can remember yourself as you actually lived Unitarian Universalism, not just a bunch of ideas on a timeline. Lived reality is our legacy. Our daily lives and the messiness that, and the heck that we all live it, not just what are our ideas.
Carol. That didn't have to be your final word, but.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Okay.
My final word is it's going to be okay. And you know, all of us are guaranteed, for us, the chapter is going to end in the middle of the book, and we're going to die. And still, it's going to be okay. And I think if we could just know that as a people, I think we could do some really good work.
I'm going to leave us with a quote from my very, very good friend. I don't know if he got it from anywhere else, so if you know it, I'd love to find out. But it's, plant a seed in the wild and a tree will grow on its own. Mm. So if you put in effort to anything, and even if you just tell one person, even if you just point out one thing that happened, even if you just share one blip of information, no matter how small, they will somehow be impacted by it. And only through that can you make positive changes, through all the small steps combined.
Thank you so much. We will be okay. So we're all right now. Thank you so much. I don't know if the three of you have business cards, or if you want to put your contact information on the flip chart over there. I think somebody's business cards, so there's not yours. Thank you all so much for being here. Jonah and I both work at Stewardship and Development, and you can find us on the website.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a little more freeform than I kind of intended, but it happens.
Where in Louisiana?